It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at a new study that gives some biofuels a bad rap.
But first, recent advances in genetic research have taught us that much of what we look like, feel like, and act like is due to our genetic makeup.
But our next guest says we also have an effect on our genes. For example, our reaction to trauma can alter the way our genes express themselves for the rest of our lives. Dr. Sharon Wallum joins us now to explain our relationship with our genes. His new book is Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. Dr. Wallum, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I remember I got an impression of genetics back in high school biology, ninth grade biology, that it's a one-way relationship. Our genes determine a big chunk of us. But it sounds like in reading your book, it's a bit of a two-way street. How much are we learning along those lines?
Well, actually, most of the rules that we kind of learn about, that you learn about in high school, that I learned about in medical school, are being completely rewritten. What we're understanding is that, something that a lot of old wives' tales that have been, kind of accepted as truth for a very long time, the fact that things in our environment have a big influence on the way our genes behave. And so regardless of the genes you inherit, what you actually experience, eat, feel, think about on a day-to-day basis changes the way in which the genes are expressed, meaning the way the genes are turned off and on. And many of these changes can result in health or disease and in, of course, well-being and in longevity. And it all depends upon which genes are being turned off and on. And we've actually known this for a very long time. It just took us a while to kind of come around to really understand the mechanisms, like the way in which this is happening. If you think about it, identical twins that are born with exactly the same DNA that they start off with early on in life, over time experience different things, they eat different things, and over time also they end up having different medical conditions.
I mentioned this briefly in the setup. Bullying, trauma can change the way our genes express themselves for the rest of our lives. You talk about in the book. Can you tell us how that works?
Yeah, this is really fascinating. And what this is all started with a study that looked at identical twins. So again, twins that are born with exactly the same DNA. And what we've now understood is this epigenetic, this is the name in which the field of study that looks at the way the pattern of genes being turned off and on over time changes. When one twin experiences bullying, that form of trauma, that kind of lays down a pattern on the genes that then get incorporated for the rest of that twin's life. And what you find out that it's not just a change on a genetic level, it's a behavioral change as well that gets imprinted. And the idea is that if you do experience some kind of trauma, there may be some kind of benefit for you to keeping your head down low and essentially not attracting too much attention. And psychological testing that was done on these twins after they experienced trauma really showed that essentially they were not really good at, or they became very nervous when they were put in front of people. Compared to the other identical twin that didn't experience trauma. And the part that really becomes fascinating is when you extend this to the animal experimentation, the animal studies that have been done, on at least there, we see that trauma, same kind of trauma that an animal experiences. So if you separate a young mouse from its mother for an hour a day for the first few days of its life, it grows up again to be traumatized, which is not a surprise. The big surprise was that the next generation, so when that little pup grows up and impregnates a female but has no contact with the next generation at all, just that kind of sperm being passed on to the next generation, that generation is also traumatized. And what we're finding is that trauma then becomes inherited in the next generation. And so the next generation behaves in the same way, even though they were not traumatized at all.
That, to me, is amazing. I mean, when you talk about rewriting the rules of genetics, that concept that something in our lives would not just change our lives, but could be passed down genetically, that's amazing. That's earth-shaking in a way.
Yeah, no, it really is mind-blowing. And in a way, it's empowering also, because it says that, no matter kind of what you inherit, also changes that you make in your life may change things for yourself and for the next generation. And really what we're finding out is that the amount of things that you can impact is practically endless when it comes to the genome. And this makes sense when you think about to be flexible, to be able then to kind of be able to deal with an environmental situation. It makes sense. It allows you that kind of flexibility. But also, it creates a situation for the inheritance of trauma, which is not, you know, that kind of rewrites all the textbooks that have been out there.
Now, you spend a lot of time in the book and in your career looking at fairly rare genetic diseases. What are the ones that, or can you give us a couple that we can learn from in terms of how our behavior can help us cope with the legacy of some of these inherited genetic diseases?
Most definitely. So for me, really, rare diseases is the key to all our health. Because when you take, you know, say an extreme example where something kind of doesn't work in our body and extend that, and the one that I always think about, the example that I talk about in the book, to really illustrate that there's no effective one diet that works for everyone. And, you know, people, I often see patients that are really frustrated because they try a diet that, you know, someone that they know at work or a good friend suggested, and it really didn't work for them. And when you kind of looked at the genes that you inherit, that makes sense. And the example that I think about and I describe in the book is Jeff the Chef. And this was one patient that I saw that in his early 30s wanted to lower his cholesterol because he had a family history of heart disease. So went to his physician, got the recommendations that you'd hear every day on television and in every doctor's office, which is cut down your saturated fats, have more grains and more fruits and vegetables. And Jeff the Chef was the kind of guy that really didn't like fruits and vegetables, would always complain of feeling bloated, but said, you know what, I'm going to try to make this change, and this is my doctor's advice, I'm in my 30s, I want to, you know, live a longer life, incorporated it for about 2 years, and then, believe it or not, ended up coming down with liver cancer because he has a medical condition called hereditary fructose intolerance, and in this condition, his body can't break down fructose, which is the common sugar that is found inside fruits and vegetables. And the reason that he was avoiding them actually naturally before he even went to the doctor was he realized it made him feel bloated, but he didn't really connect it that he had a genetic condition. And in this condition, you're born with the ability you can't break down fructose, and then metabolites, the breakdown products of it, build up in your liver and then can cause cancer. And this is the example that I use, that there's no one universal diet that you can eat that works for everyone because we've all inherited different genes. And the classic example that's really common, depending where your ancestors came from, you may not be able to break down lactose, the sugar in milk, for example, into adulthood. And actually, most people in the world, about 80% of them, can't do this. It's really Western Europeans and West Africans that inherited that ability. And therefore, the genes that we inherit really change what we can eat on a day-to-day basis.
So the lesson from Jeff the Chef isn't that we should all avoid fruits and veggies, but that one size doesn't fit all. But also, is the lesson that we should all, or more of us, know what our genes are and have our genome mapped out?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what we're really going to find today that's starting, and this is really for the early adopters, is as you say, you know, you take that step, you get your genome decoded, with that information, you can start making health changes, not just dietary, but which medications you should be on and at which dose that is specific to the individual. Because right now, all medical training doesn't really treat to treat a patient. It's the training is to treat a population. And so what you end up doing is you end up going on these recommendations, trying to see if it does fit and adjusting the dose as the patient goes, instead of saying, wait a minute, what genes did you inherit? And say a classic example is something that's fairly common in the population. It's called factor V Leiden. And if you've inherited this gene, you're very susceptible to blood clots. And so if you're a woman that's inherited this gene and you're on the birth control pill, you are at extreme risk for blood clots. You shouldn't be on the birth control pill, but no testing is done routinely to find out if you have that mutation. And so as people kind of get their genome decoded, we're going to have all this information and be able to then make these health changes.
Some people express a fear with genetic testing along the lines of, I don't want to find out that I've got a 30% higher risk for getting something that there aren't behavioral or medicinal changes I can make. I don't want that hanging over my head, so I'd rather not have that testing. How would you make the case for testing to that person?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up that point. It's really individual. It comes down to how that person feels regarding their health. And there's many different ways, there's many different strategies that you can employ. You can get testing done and say, I only want information for things that are medically actionable, meaning, you know, something I can do about it in my life currently, you know, not waiting kind of in the future, and mask the other things, the other information that that I can't do anything about. And most of the information that is medically actionable are, you know, things that can literally save your life. You know, I constantly see patients on a daily basis that weren't aware that they have, just because they had, say, for example, a family history of cancer, that they actually had things that they could do to prevent cancer in themselves. And we're seeing this every day. And the term for the group of individuals who take action early based on information are called previvors. Angelina Jolie is the classic example. If you found out she had a family history of breast and ovarian cancer, got genetic testing that was specific for that, found out she was a carrier and said, you know what, I have two choices. I can just do increased screening, or I can do a preemptive surgery. In her case, she chose preemptive surgery to take out the breast and ovarian tissue that would then become cancerous and reduce her risk from, you know, upwards of 80% of getting cancer down to 10. And so that's the big revolution that we're seeing that's being available to all of us regarding the future of genetics and healthcare.
We are on the cutting edge of genetics and medicine with Dr. Sharon Mualim. He's an award-winning geneticist, New York Times bestselling author of Survival of the Sickest. His new book, the one we're talking about, is Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. We're talking with Sharon Mualim. He's a doctor. He's an award-winning geneticist. His new book is Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes. We're talking about the cutting edge of genetics and medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on genetic testing. Have you gotten your genome mapped? What did you learn? Would you want to, or are you a little nervous about the idea? Again, 800-642-1234. We'll get your calls in just a moment. Dr. Mualim, before we do, though, something that struck me in your book, you can read a lot about a person's genes, you personally, not with a DNA test, but by looking at them. How does that work?
Well, this is a fascinating kind of subspecialty of medicine called dysmorphology. And we kind of take advantage of the fact that from a genetic perspective and a biological one, it's such a challenge for Mother Nature to actually create a body and a face that any kind of bumps on that road of development leave very telltale signs. And the face, for example, is actually made up of five separate pieces of tissue that during your embryological fetal life form by fusing together. And things that kind of happen either that you inherit or in the environment while you're developing can leave small traces. For example, if your mother was drinking a little bit of or a lot of alcohol during your pregnancy, during her pregnancy when you were in the womb, then telltale lines between your nose and your upper lip, which is called the philtrum, if you go and look in the mirror, if it's very, very smooth, for example, that might be a tip-off to the fact that you may have fetal alcohol syndrome. And so not to scare any of your listeners, but putting these small little clues together can lead you very quickly to a diagnosis.
And you tell a story of staring at a woman at a party and your wife knowing that you were diagnosing something, not just staring.
Right. And if the problem is once you actually know what you're looking for, it's very hard to turn it off.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Diane with us in Milwaukee. Diane, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Wallen, I understand that alcoholism is a genetic inherited disease, and I don't know if that's correct. If it is correct, do you see any positive relative outcome of genome mapping to alcoholism?
Diane, thank you for that great question. Can we predict and maybe avoid alcohol based on our gene map?
That's such a great question, and it's an example of where actually drawing out your family tree is a low-tech way of finding out what you're at risk for, because you don't actually even need to get genetic testing to know that. By drawing out, say, just sitting down with your family, figuring out who you're related to, what each kind of suffered from, what kind of challenges in their own life, you then can figure out what you're at risk for. And you mentioned alcoholism. And we know that there are many genes that are involved in that. And if you have had a parent who was an alcoholic, your risk can be up to about 50% of being an alcoholic yourself. And again, it depends what you've inherited and what you've experienced in your environment yourself. And we know that there's also a lot of issues regarding the environment in which you develop in that then can create risk factors for that. The one thing we know, especially for other conditions such as psychiatric conditions that follow very similar types of inheritance, that building upon resiliency, working upon strategies on how to deal with the challenges in life can then help you to reduce your risk for those certain conditions.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Greg in Augusta. Greg, hi.
Hello. I've been listening to your program, and I have Leiden factor 5. I discovered it accidentally, really, because my sisters, younger than me, also have it, and they were on birth control, and they both had blood clots in their lower leg. And so I found out about it. Well, I think genetic screening and learning about things that could save your life or extend your life for many years is just beautiful. But how is the average American going to afford to have it?
Interesting. So, first of all, how expensive is it for us, Dr. Mualim, to get genetic testing?
That's a great question, and I'm so glad that someone called exactly about Factor 5 Leiden, which we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Genetic testing, if you're looking to get everything sequenced, essentially all the 3 billion kind of letters that make up the genetic code, can run you probably about $2,000 to $3,000 or $4,000, depending on where it's done. So it is still expensive. That being said, we're talking about a price reduction that is hard to believe, which was hundreds of millions of dollars only a decade ago. And so the price is actually thought to continuously drop down, and in a year or two, we're going to end up with your entire genome being able to be sequenced for under $1,000. That being said, you don't need to get full genetic sequencing done to find out what you're at risk for. The most powerful tool you could do with your family, and this is what I describe in the book, is sit down with them, you know, at the next kind of family gathering, write out a family tree, draw it all out, figure out, you know, what your ancestors passed away from, what the living relatives, what medical conditions they have, and then that'll give you an idea of what you could be kind of tested for that is much more affordable and covered by insurance. So you actually don't need, which is actually, you know, the caller's case. I don't think you get complete genetic sequencing done. You had relatives that were discovered to have factor 5 Leiden, and then thankfully you got tested yourself, and it sounds like you inherited the gene as well. But now at least you know what you're at risk for. You know that you have a 50% chance of passing that gene on to your children, and if they're daughters, they should never be on the birth control pill.
Thanks a lot for the call, Greg. We've got Tim on the line next in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. So first I'll start by saying both parents were adopted, so that kind of cuts out the ability to talk to the adopted parent or adopt, you know, your birth parents. But I am wondering, I've had stomach issues for years and nobody's ever been able to tell me what's wrong with me. How do I go about asking my doctor, you know, hey, I want to get tested for everything that could cause my intestinal issues?
Interesting. Tim, thanks for the call. Do you have a suggestion for him?
Tim, you know, what you bring up, having adoptive parents and not having that ability, is the one thing really that sequencing, that getting that genetic testing then can provide you that couldn't provide people in the past. When it comes to digestive issues, is it something in particular?
Yeah, at first I thought it was corn, but it seems like every time I get sick I have we'll call it soft stool. Well,
we don't have time to get too deep into it. We've just got a minute left. But if we have a condition, are there usually tests we could get via our doctor, our healthcare provider?
Yeah. And so what I would suggest is to see the relative specialist for you. If it's a stomach issue, then a GI doc would be the best one. Then it can probably lead you in the right direction, especially if it involves genetic testing.
Very briefly, Dr. Mualim, this has got to be an exciting time for somebody in your line of work.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, having the rules rewritten regarding genetics and inheritance and having people, being empowered about their health is a very exciting time.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some of the latest with us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Sharon Mualim, award-winning geneticist, New York Times bestselling author of Survival of the Sickest. His new book is Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes.
It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about one woman's experience working as a physical therapist in Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
But first, a federal government study published yesterday in the journal Nature Climate Change concludes that biofuels made with corn residue release 7% more greenhouse gases in the short term compared with conventional gasoline. With us is Michael Kraft, a professor emeritus of public and environmental affairs at the UW-Green Bay, to explain what the study means for the environment and for the future of biofuels. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'd like to start by getting some background on this particular study and more specifically what they were studying. When a lot of people hear the word corn and biofuels, they automatically think of ethanol. But we're talking about something else here, aren't we?
Right. We're talking not about the corn kernels per se, but the leftovers, that is the stalk of the corn plant. And much depends in these kinds of studies on just how much of the residue is used. And I think for those who disagree with the study, that is one of the points of contention. So let's distinguish corn-based ethanol from the corn residue-based ethanol. And so this is the study is about what is called cellulosic ethanol, and that cellulosic refers to the woody parts of trees, and whether it's wood residue and from forestry operations or corn or other crops, that's a very different kind of conversion process than using corn itself.
And this is what we heard about, I think it was during the Bush administration when he was talking about switchgrass and things
that.
Same
right.
sort of
and
thing.
And the hope is over time that you do not use corn or any other food crop. Now, I think the figures are still accurate that something like 40% of the U.S. corn crop is used for ethanol production. And that has driven up the prices of corn and other food around the world. So the reason to pursue cellulosic-based ethanol rather than corn-based is to not use food crops but try something else. So the reason why the study is important is it's not worth doing any of this if it produces no benefit in terms of reduced greenhouse gases compared to gasoline. And that's the focus of the study. They said it did not produce a lowering of greenhouse gases beyond burning regular gasoline. And if that finding is upheld in later studies, that would mean cellulosic ethanol would not meet the current EPA standard for renewable biofuels and obviously would not be doing much to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the United States or anywhere else.
Now, have you had a chance to take a look at the study? And if so, what do you think?
Yeah. I've looked at summaries of the study, not the study per se, and then we can get, I'm a political scientist, not a mm-hmm. a biochemist or an ecologist. But what I saw is, first of all, you mentioned this is a federal government study. But it wasn't done by the federal government. It was done by an assistant professor of biological systems engineering at the University of Nebraska. And the EPA itself says its own analysis was different from the assumptions made in that study. And I see in one AP release, an EPA spokesperson said that the study we're talking about, quote, does not provide useful information relevant to the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions from corn stover ethanol, meaning corn residue. There's a comparison in this press release to a peer-reviewed study that the Department of Energy itself did 2 years ago, which found that biofuels made with corn residue were, in fact, 95% better than gasoline. Now, on the other side, David Tillman is a very widely regarded ecologist at the University of Minnesota, says this study suggests it will be very hard to make a biofuel that has a better greenhouse gas impact than gasoline. He says it's the best study he's seen so far. So So what I conclude from that is, as is true of many academic studies, a lot of and the conclusion depends on how the study is designed. For any energy source, you need a very complete what we call life cycle analysis. And if you make different assumptions than, for example, the Department of Energy or EPA does, you might well come to different conclusions. So my draw from this is we ought to do some more studies. We ought to be sure before we commit the nation to using cellulosic-based ethanol, or for that matter, corn-based ethanol, that it makes sense. That is, that it really does reduce greenhouse gases and is economically viable. Otherwise, there's no point in doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for people who follow biofuels and the debate over that. This just adds, I guess, more murkiness to the whole thing. It seems as though we get conflicting studies and have been getting in conflicting studies.
Yeah, we get conflicting studies everywhere. We do it on healthcare, on, you know, on food safety, on the outcomes of different medical procedures, on school voucher programs and what. This is the nature of science. And so this is the first major study that apparently has thoroughly examined the issue. There will be other studies. In the meantime, the country still has a national policy, which Congress approved in 2007, which set up this renewable fuel standard, which says we ought to be relying more on renewable fuels. And this was done in part to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also in part to reduce oil imports to the United States. Now, the oil imports have gone way down. Since President Obama took office, we've gone from 60% all the way down to what this year is estimated to be only 30%. But that's not so much from using ethanol as from increased oil and gas production in the United States and better fuel economy in U.S. cars and trucks. Still, biofuels are very important for the future. Cellulosic ethanol is only one way to do this. There are all kinds of experiments underway using algae, for example, to directly produce biofuel. And I think this is an exciting time. In the next 5 or 10 years, we'll find ways to make fuel for our cars and other purposes that is not derived from oil, namely gasoline, or is not necessarily derived from a food crop. So this is... we're early in that process, and this is one study. Looks like it's a pretty good one. Does raise some questions. EPA says they don't agree with it. DuPont, which is heavily invested in biofuels, says they don't think it was a good study either. And that's not so unusual in studies in many different fields, as I mentioned. So we'll go from here.
Yeah, but as you say, the situation energy-wise has really changed since 2007, and oil production all of a sudden is a factor here in the U.S. and that it wasn't. Does that take a lot of that pressure off that we saw back in 2007 to come up with something to replace oil?
Yeah, it does. But see, Congress was motivated at that time mainly by heavy U.S. reliance on imported oil. Now there's a different factor. I think, as most of your listeners know, this has been a year we've had three major reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the latest one coming just a short time ago. And all of these lead to increased concern about greenhouse gas emissions, mostly based on use of fossil fuels. So it's a little bit of one cause is deforestation, but mostly it's because we use coal, oil, and natural gas. We and most other countries in the world, and that simply has to change. And it has to change soon, in the next 10 to 15 years, the IPCC says. So I would say that means an intensive period of investigation of different kinds of energy technologies, and biofuels would be one of those. And we'll, you know, we go from there. We have to be sure that there's a payoff to what we're doing. But it's a little hard to tell from the present research.
So if it's not cellulosic biofuels, what other kind of biofuels do you think right now hold some promise as far as being viable in the future?
Well, again, it's hard for me. I'm not an expert in biofuels to speak to that. But I've read quite a few articles in various newspapers and journals that suggest there's a lot of promise in algae-based biofuel production. There are a lot of companies getting heavy investment from Silicon Valley venture capitalists to try to find something there. We're still very much early in this whole process. From my perspective, and I think this is what the Department of Energy at the federal level has done, is to invest heavily in cutting-edge research to find answers, just like this study produced, which is what works and what doesn't work, what is promising. How do we design better studies so we can chart a clearer path to the future? And at this point, as President Obama is fond of saying, it's all of the above. That is, we need to use a variety of energy sources, but we also need to start moving away, and to do it soon, from fossil fuels to alternatives. And any path we find that's going to be productive in that sense is worth looking at. And biofuels hold a great deal of promise. I don't think the study says that's the end of biofuels. It does suggest some caution about moving quickly toward certain ways of using cellulosic-based ethanol.
And it sounds as though you're also saying that this is not the definitive study that people should hang their hat on, that there doesn't...
Well, what I'm saying is the news releases I've seen show that the EPA and DuPont and other people who have looked very carefully at cellulosic ethanol express doubts about this study being the definitive study. And that's not unusual in the way scientific research goes. But it tells me just because one study, even though it was a pretty good one, finds that it's not better than gasoline, that's not the last word on the subject.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at the UW-Green Bay. What our next guest wanted was a decent job with normal hours, but what she got was anything but that. For years, Adele Levine was a physical therapist inside the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, which treated soldiers throughout the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan before it was closed in 2011.
And that meant treating young military personnel with debilitating combat injuries, both physically and emotionally. While the experience for her, her colleagues, and her patients was often intense, consuming, and heartbreaking, she says the atmosphere there was also filled with incredible camaraderie and, in some cases, unlikely comedy. In a new book, she details the story of her time at Walter Reed and shows a side of war not often seen.
Adele Levine is the author of Run, Don't Walk, The Curious and Chaotic Life of a Physical Therapist Inside Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Adele, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, the first question I have for you is the obvious one. Why was this a book that needed to be written? Why did you feel the need, after your time there, to do more than just walk away with some good stories that you could tell to your friends and family?
Oh, I felt that the history of Walter Reed was a really important part of American history, and I wanted to, I didn't just want to see those gates closed without people knowing what happened while we were there. You know, Walter Reed was America's oldest Army hospital. It treated soldiers from every single major war we were in, from World War I forward, and I sort of thought it was, you know, kind of incredible that I was there, and, you know, here we were. We were sort of the last chapter, and I don't know, I didn't want to forget it just for myself personally, and I wanted to create a snapshot in time.
So tell me about your path to Walter Reed. As a physical therapist, you could have gone any number of places. Why there?
I had moved into an apartment across the street, and I was signing the lease, and my landlord knew I was a physical therapist, and she just assumed I was working at Walter Reed. She pointed it out to me, and she was like, "Oh, so you're working over there, right?" And I was like, "No, you know, but I probably should."
And so you literally walked across the street, and one thing led to another?
Well, I sent my resume in.
Sure.
And it didn't happen right away, and actually by the time I started working there, I had a bad flood in my apartment, and I lost my nice basement apartment. I had to move out.
But you still got to come back and work across the street.
Yeah, I did.
So at the time, Walter Reed, as you mentioned, had a storied history. At the same time in the 2000s, and I think around 2007 or so, it also had some pretty significant challenges in terms of funding. There were, I think, some neglect cases there and so on. So it was really kind of a mixed bag. You had a lot of great legacy there, but a lot of challenges at the same time.
Well, you know, I worked in the amputee clinic. But you have to keep in mind that Walter Reed was also, in a way, also a large workman's comp facility. And they processed many, many soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, many of whom, you know, wanted to stay there because while they were there, they got premium pay or whatever. So there was, you know, there were people who were had things to gain by certain stories. You might want to look into the patients that they featured in those stories. You know, I can't speak to it. I'm not an administrator, but I can say that I thought that the care that we gave at Walter Reed was incredible. I remember having a bad having a bad kidney stone and just wishing I could have been treated at Walter Reed.
So when you went to work at Walter Reed, as you mentioned, you worked a lot with amputees. And was that assigned to you, or was that an area that you chose to explore?
Oh, I didn't choose it. When I first started working at Walter Reed in 2005, I was in the outpatient clinic, and that was really where I wanted to be. And I did that for about 2.5 years, and I was starting to feel kind of burnt out. And, you know, I went to talk to the colonel, and I told her I was feeling, you know, really kind of run down, and I thought that maybe I would apply for another job. And she told me to take a week off of work and go downtown and do, like, a staycation. And, you know, we're in D.C., so she told me I should go to all the museums. And I thought she was just crazy, you know. But, you know, so I took the week off, and I went and I saw all the museums. And then I came back to work on Monday, and she pulled me into her office, and she just said she was moving me into the amputee section.
And there you go. And in that section, you met a lot of people that stayed with you and wound up in this book. And a lot of them, of course, very young soldiers, a lot of them maybe in their early 20s, coming home with severe injuries and emotional distress as well. And the one, maybe a good example of it, is this young man named, nicknamed, I guess, Cosmo. And he used a particular word that we cannot use here on public radio, but his vocabulary was somewhat limited, but it's a terrific story, and I'm wondering if you'd share that.
Oh, sure. I mean, straight up, Cosmo was made up of three patients that I saw, and there was a Cosmo that I treated in the ICU, and then one in the outpatient clinic, and later one at the end of the book who decided to amputate his second leg. You know, when you're a physical therapist, you see hundreds and hundreds of patients, you know, and hopefully you have a long career. And after a while, you get really good at recognizing certain personalities. And I just felt like, you know, at Walter Reed, we had, you know, there are many, many stories out there about people overcoming difficult situations and triumphing. But I felt that it was also important to share a story of someone who isn't necessarily triumphing at the time because they're kind of stuck with where they are now. And I felt like Cosmo, and again, I work in a hospital, so I have to protect patient privacy. The three men that made up Cosmo really fit that bill. You know, they were having a hard time, and a lot of their difficulties were just within themselves. They were going to do what they were going to do, and they sure weren't going to listen to me. And they were angry in a way, and also they had a lot of spunk. You know, most of the injuries that we saw early in the wars were single-leg amputees, and, you know, Cosmo was a single-leg amputee when he came into the hospital, but he had very typical injuries of a Walter Reed patient in that the other leg was completely destroyed. And that was the leg that they would refer to as the intact leg in the medical chart. And his intact leg was really shattered in many pieces, probably 8 pieces. He had what they call external fixators, which are kind of like metal cages or scaffolding that goes around the leg and has pins that go into the bone and hold the broken pieces together. And you would see back then at Walter Reed, you would see many, many patients who had one amputation and then the other leg was sort of encased in these external fixators. And, you know, it was funny. Well, it wasn't funny. I mean, it's not funny, but it was the intact leg, that shattered leg, that usually gave them the most grief. Later on, many of them chose to have that other side amputated just because they had such difficulty with it. As the wars went on, we saw fewer and fewer patients with an intact leg because, you know, by 2010, 2011, most of our patients coming back were missing both of their legs. But at that time in 2009, when Cosmo came in, he had one leg and he had one amputated leg and the other one was encased in scaffolding to hold it together.
Now, in the minute or so that we have left, you know, the book that you wrote shows us a piece of war that a lot of people never really see. You see the headlines and you know, the coming home ceremonies, but you don't see this side of it. So keeping that in mind, what do you hope people take away from your story?
Well, a couple things. One is I think it's important for people to realize just how many people are behind the scenes in getting these young men and women, you know, back on their feet again. And it's often, you know, it's not just the medical staff, but I would say that, you know, everybody at Walter Reed really pitched in. There was a great deal of pride there. I mean, from the cafeteria lady who called everyone baby and sweetie to, you know, the people who worked in the gift shop. And also the patients and their families. It was a real team effort. And the other thing I would like to say is that I feel like, in a way, that my book is kind of a metaphor for this country at large, where, you know, we are going through a difficult time, and we were going through a difficult time back then, of course, at Walter Reed. But our clinic was kind of a microcosm of America. We had patients and family members and staff members from all over America and from many, many different backgrounds, and we could have let our differences.
And I'm afraid, Adele, that we're running out of time, but thanks so much for that. That was Adele Levine, the author of Run, Don't Walk, The Curious and Chaotic Life of a Physical Therapist Inside Walter Reed Army Medical Center.